Sea levels are on the rise, especially here in the Southeast. A new U.S. study, as we speak with the researcher in Gainesville, that's just ahead. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, never miss a show. Download the WJCT app. Listen to us there anytime. You can stream us live right now on Facebook, too. Just ahead, why scientists at the University of Florida say the oceans are rising even faster around our state than the rest of the country. Get on the line now with your thoughts at 549-2937. Then later, it's Movable Feast as we take a taste of Ocean 60 Fine Dining in Atlantic Beach. Plus, profiling the Sisters of Hope House. All of that and more ahead this hour. But first this morning, it's a worrying new study here in Florida about sea level rise. For people in the southeastern United States, and especially Florida, who feel that annoying tidal flooding has sneaked up on them in recent years, well, it turns out to be true, and scientists have a new explanation for it. In a paper published last week, University of Florida researchers calculated that from 2011 to 2015, the sea level along the American coastline south of Cape Hatteras rose 6 times faster than the long-term rate of global increase. In the paper published in the journal Geophysical Research Letters, the scientists proposed a mechanism to explain this rapid increase in sea level. Two large-scale atmospheric patterns, they say, have intersected to push up the water off the southeast coast. This is causing what they call a hot spot of sea level rise. So what does this mean for Florida and our first coast? Joining us by phone, we welcome Dr. Arnaldo Valle-Levinson. He's a scientist and researcher with the University of Florida in Gainesville and one of the study's authors. Doctor, thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you.
And here's our question to callers. What do you think about the new UF study looking at the rapid rate of sea level rise here in the Southeast? We want your calls. Give us a call now, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, or you can weigh in on our Facebook page where we are streaming live right now. Dr. Valle-Levinson, we've known for some time the seas are rising, and we're seeing evidence of it in Florida already, particularly in South Florida, where they're getting what they call sunny day floods, tidal floods. But your study seems to indicate that the Southeast has even more of an issue. What does the study show?
Well, you've already mentioned it, and indeed what the study shows is that this rapid increase in sea level rise does not only affect the southeast region of Florida, but the entire southeastern U.S. from Cape Hatteras to Miami. And what was exciting about this study was that it was really motivated from the fact that we were finding that in the Indian River Lagoon in east central Florida, the water from the sediments in the lagoon was fresh, completely fresh, 10 years ago. And in the past decade, it has become more and more brackish. This is what colleagues Caitlin Young and John Martin mentioned to me. And then we decided to investigate why was this? Why was it that the water from the sediments in the Indian River Lagoon was getting saltier and saltier? Mm-hmm. So we thought that there were two main possibilities, human consumption and sea level rise. While they went and investigated the effects of human consumption, we started looking at sea level rise. Well, we looked at the tide station at the entrance to Indian River Lagoon near Cape Canaveral, which is a National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration station. And we found a rapid increase in sea level between 2011 and 2015, something that was one order of magnitude larger than the global values. So then I went to my colleague, Andrea Dutton, and she said, you must be doing something wrong. This is not right. This is too fast to be real. So we started looking at more stations. We looked at stations in Southeast Florida, and all showed the same rapid increase trend. And then we looked at similar stations throughout the eastern U.S., and we found similar rates along the southeast U.S. Atlantic coast from Miami to Cape Hatteras. So we call this a hot spot, right?
A hot spot, right. Right. And Florida's in the hot spot here in North Florida, too, right?
Indeed. North Florida is. We found that there's a station right there in Jacksonville, Mayport, that shows the same trend, a rapid increase that is close to 8 times faster than the 20-year global mean rate.
8 times faster. That's significant.
Yes.
What are the long-term trends then? You're saying the increase in sea level rise in the southeast is the biggest jump since the late 1940s, about 3/4 of an inch of sea level rise per year over the last 4 years. That doesn't sound like a lot, but we're talking billions of extra gallons of water off the southeast coast that can come into streets, lawns, when tides and winds push it inland, even on sunny days. We're already seeing that, particularly in South Florida. In Miami, they're dealing with this regular flooding now as a consequence of these rising oceans. And given your new data, what are you, when you look out 5, 10 years, 20 years, what are you seeing, Doctor? What are you seeing?
Right. So the general trend is a smooth increase. We're talking about approximately 1 foot per century. So that might not seem like a lot. 1 foot over 100 years, right? So that's a steady increase. But superimposed on that steady increase, we have these rapid increases, but also rapid decreases. So if what we have observed in the past 100 years persists, we're going to see, following this rapid increase, we should expect a rapid decrease. But again, we have to keep in mind that this is superimposed on this long-term trend to increase, right? So you can think of this as a storm surge, and superimposed on the storm surge, you have the waves. So what we're describing in our studies are these waves superimposed on the storm surge. So the storm surge would be the long-term sea level rise that is increasing at 1 foot per century. And superimposed on this, we have rapid increases and decreases. So what we need to be careful is that when sea level starts to stop increasing as fast, not to relax our awareness of the fact that the ocean is coming. The ocean is attacking us. In fact, the ocean is already here, right?
Yeah, and people in our neck of the woods here in Jacksonville may not be noticing it quite as much, but South Florida is getting socked regularly. Some of that has to do with their topography down there. And it's interesting, what's so interesting about your study, Doctor, is that, you know, we tend to think of the ocean as consistent with the level being the same everywhere and rising consistently everywhere. But what your study shows is that the ocean is lumpy. Water gets pushed around. It's there are hills and valleys, right?
Absolutely. Well, and not only our study shows that, we've known this. If you look at an image of the surface of the ocean everywhere, you have bumps and troughs everywhere in the ocean, and that's what drives actually the Gulf Stream that determines so much of our climate and weather patterns in Florida entirely. Yeah.
All right, let's go to your calls for Dr. Arnaldo Valle-Levinson, one of three researchers at the University of Florida in Gainesville, out with a new landmark study looking at the rapid rise of the oceans in the southeast, far outpacing other parts of the country, other parts of our coastline in America. What do you think about this? What are your questions? What are your concerns? 549-2937. CJ is in St. Nicholas. Hey, CJ, good morning. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. My question for the doctor is, Jacksonville is right now probably moving forward with dredging St. John's River. How is this new information, are we able to take this into consideration as far as our plans to manipulate the waterways, and are there implications? And then the second part of my question real quick is, you had mentioned storm surge. How will this problem impact or exacerbate storm surge in the event of a tropical system like Hurricane Matthew, for instance? So how does that go hand in hand? So thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. Doctor.
Yeah, so I was using the storm surge phenomenon as an analogy, but I will respond to the two parts of the question. So when you dredge an estuary like the St. John's River, the tide becomes less affected by the effects from the bottom. So what that allows is for the tides to amplify in the system. This has been shown in many places in Europe where they dredge, in the Ems River and in the Guadalquivir River. The Guadalquivir is in Spain. The Ems River separates Germany from the Netherlands. When they dredge those systems to allow deeper vessels to go in and out, the tide amplifies and the tidal currents strengthen. The ocean water intrudes further into the estuary. So those are tremendous impacts. And since the tide amplifies, that causes more flooding whenever there's a high tide. So indeed, dredging of the St. John's will likely produce more sunny day flooding.
Okay.
Yeah, indeed. And very important is the enhancement of the intrusion of ocean water further upstream into the St. John's River, where a lot of fresh water is extracted, right? So it's a serious effect, the dredging of an estuary. In addition, you get because of the tidal currents increase, then we have more suspended sediment. The water becomes more turbid, and that poses an environmental threat also, right? Less availability of light for the phytoplankton, which are the organisms that produce oxygen and provide food for fish. So it's a very serious implication. That's a good question.
Yeah, sure
is.
Yeah. If you're just tuning in, as we learn about University of Florida's new study, it shows that sea level rise in the southeast is spiking at much higher rates than elsewhere. Find out why and give us a call. It's 549-2937. What are your thoughts and questions about this? Lots of interesting questions coming into the show right now. Emmett is in Wonderwood this morning. Hey, Emmett, how's the ocean? How's
Good
the
morning.
River looking in your part of the woods?
Oh, it's a beautiful thing every day, two high tides a day. But this question deals with the coastline. For many years, I was a lifeguard back in the 50s out at Jack's Beach, and we used to drive on the beach, and the beaches have really not changed. But with the big storms, I was sitting on a bulkhead once when a hurricane was coming in, and then it went straight out to sea. But it ate away everything, just like Matthew just did. So one of my ideas many years ago, which still I want to ask the doctor if it would work, is to put a giant, like a giant pier, but it wouldn't be a pier. It would just be the poles from a place where the ocean is, like on the way to St. Augustine, it's eating into the road. Put the pier out maybe 2 miles, and maybe after you go out about a mile, make it into a cross so that drifting sand would be, and you could pump it full of sand, these poles, which would be deep embedded, would become a giant sand dune at that point on the coastline. And it would be a way to preserve and create big sand dunes off the coast. It would be different. No one's done it yet that I know of. And I just wondered if it would work.
If it would work. Dr. Levinson.
It might work temporarily, but the unintended consequences would be immense. This has been shown over and over again. You know, so that sand goes to feed some beach north or south of that region, and that beach would be starved of sand, so it will be severely eroded. So one spot will, you will retain sand at one spot, but you will severely cause erosion at other spots, either north or south of that spot. So it's a reasonable way of capturing sand, but only at that one spot. You create problems away from that spot.
So it's like whack-a-mole, isn't it, kind of?
Yeah, right.
Oh,
yeah.
Man. All right. Linte in St. Augustine. Good morning. How is beautiful St. Augustine?
Oh, yes, it's beautiful today. Yes, I'm from the Netherlands, and the Netherlands has been fighting with water. In Holland, there is a saying, God created the world, but the Dutch created the Netherlands. So, you know, and yeah. The engineers are always thinking ahead. And if you see the systems they put already in place, you know, because there is going to be more water in the seas. The ice caps are melting. Florida was twice under 200 feet of ice. And there was no, you know, and the heat came and it melted it. So...
That's right. And you know, in the Netherlands, they really look at the dealing with the water rise as just a way of life, correct?
Right.
Yeah, yes. It's just part of their lives, yes. Part of their culture.
And here, you know, I live on the island in St. Augustine, Anastasia Island. Luckily, I'm on a dune. I'm 10 feet above sea level. In Holland, I live 9 feet below sea level. But... but some part of our street, the western part of our street, was underwater, 3-4 feet, and it is sewage water, and they had to throw out everything, and now they have rebuilt. But then they have not done anything to prevent this the next storm, and it could very well happen again.
Yeah.
They could make sluices like they did in the Netherlands over the rivers. You know, where the Matanzas River comes from the sea or goes out into the sea, and they can close it off. And the northern part of the Matanzas River can also be closed off. And we wouldn't have this flood.
Sure. Thanks for that call. And I so appreciate that, because we're getting emails about that as well, Doctor. Here's one from Rob in San Marco. Recently, we lived in San Marco in a rental unit. The streets would flood often and heavily when there was a combination of high tides and rainfall, and sometimes high tide with no rain. Cars in the neighborhood were damaged. How are the planners of Jacksonville addressing this issue? This is going to become a more critical infrastructure issue, not just for Jacksonville, but as you're saying, for all of the southeast and eastern seaboard coastline. As you continue to study this, how municipalities are going to plan for these sea level rise, high tide, sunny day flooding events, and worse. What are you seeing in terms of the response to your study, Doctor, from municipalities?
Yeah, well, definitely this period of 2011-2015, when we have found out this rapid increase in sea level, should be a wake-up call for all municipalities, a wake-up call of what's coming and how to prepare for it. And it shouldn't be a band-aid cure to the problem. There should be a serious effort to prepare for that, just like the Dutch caller was mentioning. The Netherlands is perhaps the most advanced country in the world in terms of dealing with the attack of the ocean to their to land. Right? Obviously, their great part of their country is below sea level, so they have to be quite concerned about that. So the municipalities need to be quite concerned about these too, that, as I was saying, the ocean is not coming in the future. It's already here. So... what provisions, and these have to be very, very, very difficult decisions to take in order to mitigate the effects of the ocean on coastal communities, because this is a wake-up call. This hotspot that we had recently is a wake-up call.
It's 549. Yeah, let me go to a few more calls for you as we talk about the new UF study on rising oceans. 549-2937. Jeremy on the Jacksonville University campus. Hey, Jeremy. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. I was just calling in to commend the researchers. This is great. These sea level rise is such a complex issue with many, many factors, from atmospheric factors to geologic underpinnings. It's great to be looking at some of these less studied factors, such as the interactions of atmospheric pressure systems. It's a problem that affects the entire coast. It makes the nuances of where you are on the coast very, very important. So where you are on the coast and what factors happen to play into your local sea level rise. I don't want to take up a lot of time, but I also wanted to point out that people beyond the coast need to be thinking about these things. There's an old saying that a rising tide lifts all boats. Well, a rising sea level lifts all water levels. There are also studies showing that as the sea levels come up, interior water systems, so the water table underneath all our feet, is actually going to rise as well. So places that were normally, you know, slightly swampy are going to become more swampy. Places that were never wet before are going to start draining slower or collecting water. It's just great that we're actually having these conversations now. It's kind of pertinent because they're starting to appear in our backyards, literally. But it's great that we're spending time and looking at these features and having these conversations.
Yeah, thanks, Jeremy, for that. Haratsu in Mandarin. Haratsu, how are you?
Fine, thank you very much. I have a question from Dr. Levinson. I can understand the universal elevation of the water around the world, but focal elevation, how can we say that it is the focal elevation of the water and not focal, sinking of the land? Is the technology available to differentiate between these two changes?
Yeah, thanks for that. Yeah, doctor.
Yeah, definitely. We have measurements from tide gauges, which are referred to benchmarks. So the sinking of the tide gauges is monitored by benchmarks that don't move, on one hand. And then on the other hand, you have measurements from satellites that measure the distance from the sensors on the satellite to the water surface. And our results, our findings are consistent with both type of measurements, with tide gauges and with satellite measurements. Satellite measurements are not affected by the changes of elevation in land, so subsidence, what we call subsidence. So that's not a concern in our results.
And here's an email for you, somewhat related, from Rob. Can your guest talk about geological rebound and remission from glaciers? I thought some land areas of the U.S. are rising and some are sinking. Is this true?
That is correct. Yes.
So how does that play? How does that factor?
It definitely factors in. It makes the regions that are sinking even more vulnerable to sea level rise. The regions that are rebounding, which are few actually, make them less vulnerable to these increases in sea level. But I think we have more regions affected by the effects of sea level rise than not.
Let's take one more call. It's William in Riverside. Hey, William. Good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning, Melissa. I just wanted to point out, like, you guys said that, you know, these are going to be very difficult, decisions to make on how we're going to deal with this. Anything that you choose is going to be incredibly expensive, and it's going to have to be paid for by all of us. But one thing that I never hear brought up, I mean, here are the, you know, various engineering aspects of how we can go about this, but we never hear about, is it just hubris where people are living? Like, what are we really, are we going to install $1 billion, like, floodgates to protect what? A couple very wealthy people's fancy home from the beach? Perhaps they shouldn't live in a place that's being completely eroded away over time that we know is going to get worse and amplify with the, you know, climate change. So maybe one thing we should consider is pulling human settlement away from these affected areas ahead of time to prevent what is arguably going to be the complete destruction of their homes that are going to get swallowed up into the sea. Perhaps maybe we should make it so that the next time they're destroyed by a hurricane, you get your insurance payout, but the stipulation is that you are not allowed to rebuild in the same spot. That's just my idea. wanted to put that out
there.
Sure,
yeah. Thanks, William. Yeah, and, you know, that's been brought up before when you talk about sea level rise and coastline development, Doctor. It's certainly, though, not an argument that is taking hold. Coastline development continues apace. What about his argument?
Yeah, I mean, those are great arguments, I think. These are definitely questions that should be asked at the municipality level. What do we do? Try to protect something, try to protect a property that will be damaged 2 years down the road, even if we protect it now? Or do we try to retreat strategically in a way that's least damaging to the community? But those are questions that need to be asked, definitely. And I liked what the caller was, the questions that the caller was posing. And we need to think about those questions, definitely. Because I will say it for the third time, the ocean is already here.
And we appreciate you sharing your insights with us. On the line from Gainesville, he's one of the authors of the new landmark study out of University of Florida on rising waters in the southeast, Dr. Arnaldo Valle-Levinson. Thanks for joining the show.
It's my pleasure.
Much more still ahead. Meanwhile, later, hear about the Sisters of Hope House here on the First Coast. But up next, Movable Feast visits fine dining in Atlantic Beach as we step inside Ocean 60. Back in a moment.
Parents often complain that their kids' pop music is far more sexual than what they grew up with, but history teaches us that's not true. From 19th century New Orleans through early rock and roll to today's top 40, sex and race were always part of pop. NPR music critic Ann Powers on her new book, Good Booty, next time on 1A. Weekdays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next episode of Hometown, handmade artisan donuts are on the menu at Jacksonville's newest donut shop, Good Dough. One of America's most notable neurosurgeons, Dr. Alfredo Quiñones, talks about his unique and inspiring life story. Recycling and refurbishing end-of-life electronics is the mission of Urban Mining. Local children with life-threatening illnesses enjoy a fun-filled event at the annual Dream Day celebration. And the historic neighborhood of Springfield celebrates Independence Day every year with a throwback baseball game that brings the whole community together. It's Hometown, Thursday night at 8 on WJCT Public Television.
Sponsored in part by Downtown Investment Authority.
So I go home and I tell my mother, and I say, Ma, I'm not going to be a doctor. I'm going to work to clean up hazardous waste. I'm going to be an engineer. My grandmother said, baby, why do you want to work on a train?
Join us next time for the Moth Radio Hour, true stories told live from the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
Saturdays at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
Convinced you've heard it all before? Well, at Indie Endeavor, we challenge that notion. Tune into WJCT's After Hours for the best songs you've never listened to. Tuesdays at 11 p.m.
Support for Movable Feast is made possible by 927 Events, event venue and catering.
Welcome back. It's fine dining by the beach, and it's one of the best restaurants in town. In today's Movable Feast, Lee Court of the Women's Food Alliance speaks with Chef Daniel Groeschel of Ocean 60 in Atlantic Beach.
Have a banana, Hannah. Try the salami, Tommy. Give it the gravy, Davy. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Try a tomato plate, too.
Hello, everybody. This is Lee Court on Movable Feast. And if I had to choose one restaurant in Northeast Florida, in the Jacksonville area, that's my go-to restaurant whenever I want a great dinner, the best martini, the most warm, caring service and a place to really call home. It's Ocean 60. And I'm so happy to have with me today Chef Danny Grischel.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be with you.
I have been a big fan of yours for a long time, and I can't wait to hear the story about what has inspired you from your childhood to become a chef.
You know, I kind of just fell into it. I was blessed enough to have a mother who was a master entertainer. Dinner at our house was not just your average. It was a 4 or 5 course with wine and much of a Renaissance woman. And it kind of just was bred into us as children. And from there, it just went on.
So you grew up in Jacksonville?
Yes. Out of 3 boys, I'm the youngest. And I was the only one born here. So I'm a local Jacksonvillian. There's not many of us. But so I spent my time here at the beaches, Jacksonville Beach. Grew up on 15th Avenue South. I would ride my bike down into Atlantic Beach and grab lunch at AB Sandwich Shop, which is now the location.
I've heard of that.
Yes, it's now the location of Ocean 60. So it was destined, I guess you could say. So
for people who are not familiar with Atlantic Beach, can you give us a little demographic description and how Ocean 60 fits into the culinary culture there?
Absolutely. Atlantic Beach is a very unique area. It's a very bohemian little section of the beaches where they've done a great job in preserving the history of Atlantic Beach. Not a lot of change, per se. The people that have lived there for a long time. The houses have gone down through generations, and they're, for lack of a better word, protective, and it's just a really neat community. You have the opportunity to come, not only just to eat, but to walk and shop. There's boutiques. You come for the evening. You come to spend 4 or 5 hours, if it's not in one restaurant, hearing music. It's having a martini at Ocean 60 and then walking around and grabbing a custard or down to the beach for the evening. So it's really a unique spot as opposed to a destination restaurant where you go, enjoy yourself, and then move on. You actually kind of have an opportunity to spend the evening there.
All of Atlantic Beach is the destination because it is a pedestrian community.
Very much so.
And I can go back many years ago. By the way, when did Ocean 60 open?
We opened up in 01. So it's
16 years.
Yes.
Okay, I know that I've been a patron probably for 15 of those, and every time I've come there, I've wanted to walk on the beach first and then come in and dine.
Always had a very hospitable home. We were lucky enough to travel through Europe and Central America and eat different foods and be exposed to different cultures. So it just comes natural to just want to share that and have a good time. And we throw a party every night.
Now, I could start naming some of my favorite dishes there, but I can only tell you, Chef Grischel, that one of my anticipations every evening when I come there is to bring my honey, have a great martini, a classic James Bond martini. My husband has a scotch on the rocks, and we always begin with Brussels and mussels. The mussels are always the best, but the Brussels sprouts, there's something about those Brussels sprouts. They become my signature, sometimes a meal. So let's talk about your food. Let's talk about the origin and the evolution of your cuisine.
Absolutely. Well, I went to culinary school in Hyde Park, New York, trained under a group of amazing chefs from Germany to Spain, France. So the basis of Ocean 60 are classical techniques that we've tried never to stray away from. We make our own breads, our pastries, our stocks, everything, our salad dressings are all made from scratch. But then we add to it what the local people would like. And it's kind of an American regional twist, but we use a lot of local seafood. I have great relationships with a lot of the divers. They bring me diver shot fish. Everything's fresh. Meat's cut daily. And then the driving force behind the creativity is to really just focus on like a intercontinental cuisine, and just go with the heart, what you feel like doing that day, and really just digging into it. You mentioned the Brussels sprouts, something that not a lot of people really care for, but we've converted a lot of people into Brussels fans.
Well, I have become an expert because they have become popular on many restaurants' menus. And you are my barometer of the A+. Nobody even gets near to the way you roast them and toss them and season them. They're a great treat. What do you see coming up in the next year at Ocean 60?
You know, the neighborhood is growing exponentially, and it's exciting. It's exciting to see and to, you know, forecast. I've been there 16 years now. It seems to have flown by. But looking into the future, I see a lot of growth, and we are kicking around some rebranding and opening up some of the restaurant on the outside to where there's more outdoor dining.
Love it.
To more of an alfresco type feeling, to where it's the slide doors on.
We're at the beach.
Yeah,
we have to be outside.
It's a see or be seen neighborhood, and we are looking forward to making those changes. Have another 15, 16 years there. So
that's fabulous. Well, I'm so delighted you joined me on Movable Feast. I cannot wait till next Thursday evening because you always have some tasty music. I will be at a corner table with my James Bond martini and hopefully bartender Jeff. And starting out with my Brussels sprouts and dreaming about the giant fish.
Oh, well, we will have it ready for you. I can't wait to see you.
Thank you. I'll see you at Ocean 60.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Everybody eats when they come to my.
That's Lee Cord of our Movable Feast segment. Well, a lawsuit has been filed in Jacksonville against private equity firm Apollo Global Management. The suit contends Apollo conspired to swipe $20 million in a Dutch logistics company by arranging a complicated debt for equity restructuring without notifying company management. This is an international lawsuit with Jacksonville ties since it also involves employees from CTI Logistics. To talk about it, we're joined by attorney and former Jacksonville City Council President Jack Webb. Good morning, Jack.
Melissa, good morning. How are you today?
Good to have you.
Good
also
to see you.
On the phone with us, former Director of Human Relations for CTI Logistics, Mike Nicoletti. Mike, thanks for joining the show.
Oh, you're welcome. Glad to be here.
Jack, let's start with you. Apollo supposedly pulled off this fraud back in 2013 by arranging a debt for equity restructuring of a company called SIVA without notifying the management. And then they bought up a chunk of that discounted debt. Kind of complicated to follow. Can you tell us a little bit about this and the Jacksonville connection?
Yeah, it's interesting. You mentioned CTI Logistics. This is actually SIVA Logistics, but CTI was a wholly owned subsidiary of CSX for a number of years before it was sold to TNT Logistics, and the North American headquarters for TNT was based here in Jacksonville. Apollo Global Management, headed by Leon Black, one of the largest private equity investors in the world, came in 2007 and bought up TNT, merged it with a company called Eagle Logistics, and created SIVA. What had happened at the time was Apollo was the sponsor of an employee equity plan where the employees were given an opportunity to purchase up to 8.3% of the minority equity. Again, given what happened over that period of time, it's essentially that Apollo issued a bunch of debt. They bought up their own debt when the economy was bad, and they did a swap out in the Cayman Islands and essentially destroyed all of the equity for the 8.3 or 8.6 minority shareholders. A large portion of those individuals reside here in Jacksonville. Mm-hmm. It is an international class. They're all over the world by virtue of SIVA, by virtue of TNT and Eagle, but there's a large concentration of smaller investors who are located here in Jacksonville because of the CTI Logistics TNT Logistics connection, Mike Nicoletti being one of them.
Wow, Mike. So this really is a global matter. As former director of human relations for the company, what's your position on all of this?
Well, my position as an investor, I'm no longer with the company, but as an investor, I remember joining in. I had spent almost 30 years with CSX, and I left them went to what was then TNT, became SIVA, and I had always tried to participate as a member of management in these types of offerings when they came, because, you know, you try to demonstrate that you're part of the team and you're active and you're supportive. What happened, I was not visible to anything that Jack has discovered. But from an individual investor, what it looked like was black box in and black box out.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, we were told there was nothing there. Without any intervening, hey, we're in trouble, hey, this, hey, that, nothing. Unlike all the different things I experienced at CSX, which was very open right in front of you, and you knew where everything was.
Wow. This is a complicated fraud to pull off, it sounds like, Jack Webb. And how common is this type of scheme?
Well, it happens all the time. I don't want to say all the time, but it happens more often than it should. I know the SEC has been looking into this. And Apollo has been tagged on a number of different occasions by the SEC for some of this behavior. But really, it was very secretive. There was some. I was lucky enough to receive documents that were produced pursuant to an administrative dissolution in the Cayman Islands that got knocked up to the bankruptcy court for the Southern District of New York.
Mm-hmm.
So those documents served as the basis of this complaint. But it was only at that time that we became privy to those documents, to the information in those documents, that the blatant fraud, the blatant front running, the freezing out of the minority shareholders became apparent to all. That said, then that prompted my efforts to kind of cobble all of the disparate, all of the diaspora, CTI, TNT, Eagle, SIVA people together and move forward with filing of this lawsuit.
And filed in federal court.
Yes.
What's the next step? Where does this go from here?
We're serving Apollo either today or tomorrow. The summons has been issued. We have named as defendants the individual directors of SIVA Investments Limited as well. Getting service on them will be more problematic in as much as they're in Europe right now, but we're tracking them down. At that point, we've got a lot of briefing to do. Hopefully, we will be in a position to – we really don't want to litigate this thing if we don't have to, but we will. The claims are sound. The fraud is apparent. We just want to get the money back for those individuals who were violated.
And Mike Nicoletti, do you have hope of that, or is this more about the principle of it at this point for you?
Well, it's both. I think the principle is there. I think a number of us who were investors were just sort of shocked at the end of it. And so without any explanation, I got in the mail, you know, documents and were an email from the Cayman Islands, you know, with a stamp on it. And this is no longer, you know, in existence and it has no value. Sorry, Charlie. And it wasn't even signed by anybody.
What a crazy story.
It is. And the reality is there is value. It was just a classic freeze out of the minority equity interests, capitalizing the majority investors capitalizing on buying debt on the street, their own debt on the street at a discount, and violating the rights of the minority shareholders.
Well, keep us posted, and thanks, guys, for being with us.
Certainly will. Thanks, Melissa.
You're welcome.
He's attorney, former Jacksonville City Council President Jack Webb, Mike Nicoletti, former Director of Human Relations for CTI Logistics. We'll follow this lawsuit as it progresses through federal court here in this district of Florida, and we'll be right back.
Hi, this is Chris Thiele inviting you to join us this weekend for a Prairie Home Companion from the Pasadena Convention Center with our guests Ryan Adams, Casey Musgraves, Justin Hurwitz, Mr. Kevin Nealon, also the Royal Academy of Radio Actors, Tim Russell, Serena Brooke, and sound effects man Fred Newman, of course. Ms. Aoife O'Donovan will be there. My Song of the Week and much, much more, all right here.
Saturday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Judges are confirming what listeners already know. The WJCT News team is among the best in the nation and the state of Florida. This year, WJCT News took home national awards for Best Arts Reporting and Best Talk Show, as well as statewide honors including Best Newscast and Best Continuing Coverage. For excellent journalism, stick with WJCTNews.org and 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world, your news.
Want to learn more about nutrition and weight loss? Join WJCT and Baptist Health for Girls Day Out Saturday, August 26th at the Hyatt Regency Hotel. Spend the day with experts that will engage you to be a better you. Enjoy breakfast, lunch, session, gift bag, and so much more. Tickets are just $40. Log on to wjct.org/girlsdayout and get your tickets today.
On the next Fresh Air, Max Brooks, author of the zombie survival guide World War Z and a new novelization of the video game Minecraft. His books are his way of dealing with fears he grew up with, like the AIDS epidemic, earthquake, and nuclear war. He now works with the military on preparedness training. Max is the son of Mel Brooks and Anne Bancroft. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Welcome back finally this hour. It's a place for local women recovering from alcohol and drug addiction to get the help they need. Sisters of Hope House is a sober living environment for women, and their mission is to uplift and inspire women on the road to recovery. They are also expanding to help more women on the First Coast. Here with the good news, we welcome board members Carla Garrigan and Amy Kilgore. Ladies, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
So tell us about Sisters of Hope House. Big news, you're expanding.
We are expanding.
It was a bit ironic at the one-year anniversary of our first home. We opened our Phase 2 home just a couple of weeks ago, so we're really growing faster than we can keep up with in some ways, with women knocking on our door every single day, calling every single day. So, but it's a wonderful journey.
And you're expanding your physical location and scope of services both?
We started out originally with one house over on the west side, and phase two is a second house. So we have two locations going on now, but both still on the west side of Jacksonville.
And the need must really be there.
The need is there. Unfortunately, we get a phone call every day. People hearing about this all-women's facility. We get phone calls from drug court, rehabs and detox. The word is definitely getting out there.
Sober living environments are common all over the country, but I would think for women in a sober house, there might be some different programs or tweaks. Well, tell me a little bit about the program.
Well, we are the only sober women's home in Jacksonville, a nonprofit. So you know that our need, our audience expands all the way. We have a lady that came from Tennessee all the way down to Tampa. So our program, really, they choose their 12-step program. Our job, as you said, is to empower, uplift, and inspire them so that they can become productive members of society and get back on their feet and transition back into their own living arrangements. And we help with jobs. We help with even IDs. We have women that come directly off the street, scooped up off the street. So it's really a beautiful sight and a beautiful thing to watch.
Sure. And with the expansion, and by the way, as you expand to a second location, you need some stuff. So people can call Sisters of Hope House or go to their website, sohhjacksfl.com. Or they can come out to Hamburger Mary's in a few weeks. Can you tell us about this big party you're having?
Yes, we can. We usually have a fundraiser every month because we are a nonprofit organization. So we rely heavily on the community to get out here and help us raise some money for these girls. Monday, September 11th at Hamburger Mary's. This will be our second time there. We're having a bingo fundraiser, and it is a blast. Our residents will be there, our board members will be there, and we have huge support from the recovery. So we look forward to seeing everybody out there.
Just come out that night, and part of your ticket price will go to Sisters of Hope House?
Every bit of the ticket price. Yes.
How exciting.
It's really wonderful. They're really supportive of us as well. And, of course, ham bingo is fun. And a little bird told us that one of their celebrities will be our MC. So that's going to be great.
It's Sisters of Hope House, and as they expand to a second location, learn more at sohhjacksfl.com. And come support them September 11th at Hamburger Mary's. Board members Carla Garrigan and Amy Kilgore, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so much.
That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chepchik. Never miss a show. Download the WJCT app to listen anytime. Next on 1A, how to contain the threats of hate groups and still preserve everyone's First Amendment rights. That's coming up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and this has been First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.